Friends, I appreciate the opportunity to see all of you. I can't quite see all of you, but there's so many old friends and acquaintances in the audience. Do we have some new people here that we haven't seen before? I'm sure you must have some. Can you raise your hand if this is your first Baha'i meeting, just so I have some idea? There's a few. Okay, thank you. You're sitting close to well-informed Baha'is. They'll be able to tell you all the things that I won't tell you tonight. But I'd like to give a talk that's a little bit of an overview about the cause and some of the things that I've been thinking about in recent times. You know, having left Haifa and the position that I occupied there, I now am situated in California. So I usually tell the friends that I'm not here to give you a call or rally to action, as I feel that's inappropriate now that I have a hammock in California. And but I do like to move around, and after years of reading piles and piles of administrative papers, I'm happy to be able to look at the writings again. And they're full of, as you know, full of excitement. And when they asked me for a subject tonight, I said the coming of age. I wasn't sure just exactly what that would mean, but it seems to me it's a broad enough title that I can include all kinds of things under it. Nabil said the coming age, but I'm not quite sure if I could address that properly. So, coming of age, yes, coming of age both of it is at an individual level as individuals, and coming of age as part of the social evolution of mankind is a theme that, as you know, recurs over and over in the Baha'i writings. And the two of them, in a sense, run parallel. The additional requirements, the opportunities, the blessings, the obligations that are related to coming of age as a Baha'i at this time, in this period of the faith, I think are fairly clear to all of us. The coming of age of mankind is part of a long social evolution, we're told, in the writings of Shoghi Effendi, that began as early as Adam, with Adam, and has moved through different stages representing various periods of unification of mankind, first at the family level and then at the tribal level and finally at the level of the city-state and now nationhood, which is really reached its prime during the time we're alive and is calling for a new stage of development in social evolution, which is the global stage, and which, as you know, Baha'u'llah has announced is the intention of God, the wish and desire of our Creator in this day that we might become as one people, that we might realize the unification of the whole human race. And at the same time, we've been then gifted with inspiration and new sciences and new developments, which really have put us all, as someone said some years ago, into one neighborhood. Being now so close physically, we have to learn to be close spiritually. And part of that coming of age is a great change in the way we view each other. And moving in this unity, towards this unity, we see all kinds of signs of it in the outside world. We look for them, I think, as Baha'is, because we're interested in seeing those signs of progress towards the goal. But the youth of today, the latest generations, are very much in tune with youth all over the world. That's kind of transcended the differences and distances which existed in the past between peoples. So in the field of sport, for example, there's international awareness of athletes and what they're doing, and think of the Olympic Games as a stage for the recognition of the oneness and wholeness of the human race. Or modern music, it has some of its downsides too, but it's listened to all over the world faithfully. And lately, youth have been united through the kind of language they have to use when they don't speak a common language, which is a kind of internet English, which we're, those of us in this room are fortunate that we speak English, even though we might not fully understand internet English. It took me a while to catch up with LOL. I write things and people would write back LOL. And I said, for a long time I thought it was lots of love, but some of the things I was saying, some of the things I was saying didn't match that particular expression. So. Baha'u'llah reaffirms the announcement of the Bab that we had reached the age of the fulfillment of so many of the past prophecies of the religions of the past, and declared that the reality of the religions of the past, the trueness of the religions of the past, is an important principle which somehow we have to get across to mankind. Baha'u'llah has given us a marvelous instrument for that, and that's the Book of Certitude, the Kitab-e-Iqan. It's one of the main factors holding back the development of mankind, as much as religion is ignored, is the fact that all these revelations and the foundation, the core teachings of each of these revelations of the past is really part of a progressive revelation, that there's one God, and as you know, there's one religion, and that religion has had its expressions in different periods. Now, in the Iqan, Baha'u'llah is addressing the uncle of the Bab, the herald of the faith. And he is concerned that the prophecies in Islam don't match the circumstances of the Bab's life. And those were the questions he centered those questions in addressing Baha'u'llah, asking him if he could help him to understand. And Baha'u'llah has given this Book of Certitude, which far transcends the problems of the uncle. It addresses all of the people of the world, all the followers of great religions, who have this problem that the next religion after their religion, because of the way their religion has evolved and, if I could say, in some sense, fossilized, become fixed in certain attitudes, which then have kept the followers of that religion from embracing their promised one when he came. And Baha'u'llah uses, in the case of the Iqan, the Christians not recognizing Muhammad when he came. Abdu'l-Bahá, in his travels in the West, gave the case of the Jews, who had fixed certain ideas in their mind how their Messiah had to appear and what conditions he had to fulfill. And Baha'u'llah then addresses the problems that the Muslims had with, that the Christians had with Muhammad's coming, and likens that finally in the second half of the book to the problems that the uncle is having with the Bab. And he goes into an interpretation of various elements of the holy books, certain terms that have been misunderstood, one of the main ones having to do with sovereignty, that is that the manifestations of God, as we call them in the Baha'i teachings, these prophets of God come with absolute sovereignty, but they also come in a human station at the same time, and the appearance of having to suffer the outrages of their enemies and hunger and all types of human shortcomings, demonstrating clearly that they're in a human body and that they are human realities, has been a veil, has been a shadow that the people haven't been able to penetrate. And then they say, well, Christ was supposed to come on the throne of David. And the Jews said, where is the throne and where is the sovereignty of David? How does he manifest that? It's, you know, here he is, he's a carpenter and he's hardly has a place where he can lay his head, and all of these things that became veils for them. And yet we see how at length, and Baha'u'llah also dwells on this in the Kitab-e-Iqan, we see how at length his sovereignty was extended over the whole known world, and the kings brought their crowns to his inheritor, so to speak, even though some of that was more complicated than I want to go into tonight, but the papacy and all the other things that were there. But the kings of the world still take pride in their Christian origins. So the sovereignty finally comes out, and of Islam the same, when Baha'u'llah explains about the sovereignty of Muhammad, he says, at first this was not at all evident, but in the long run, it became manifest. Entering into many more details than we can really examine this evening, he traces this history to show this history that this is a repetition, that one of the proofs of the coming of a manifestation of God is the opposition that he raises. And the same arguments appear over and over again on the part of people. Now, as Baha'is, Shoghi Effendi calls us to a very careful study of the Kitab-e-Iqan. He says, if we become masters of its content, we'll be equipped to discuss these things with others, and that our arguments and our presentation will have this breath of life in it and change people and attract them to the cause. Now, I know now we've come some period since Baha'u'llah's coming, and so many people have just moved away from religion that it may occur to us that they don't want to hear about such things, and indeed it may be. But on the other hand, I think any sensible person, when he hears the whole plan of progressive revelation from Adam until now, and this concomitant parallel social evolution of mankind, is going to be struck by the beauty and symmetry of it all. And maybe we'll reconsider some of the things that he finds a failing in the religions of the past. There is a spiritual core, Abdu'l-Bahá says, of all of the religions, which is the same. And this is the first call of the Baha'i faith, is the independent investigation of truth, that we should in an unfettered manner examine the teachings of past revelations. And we'll see that the core teachings, the spiritual reality of it, is all the same. And in that way, it will confirm us to the oneness of God and the oneness of religion, and bring us to a point where we may then investigate and compare the heart of the Baha'i teachings and Baha'u'llah's message with that same standard, and realize that we have now in this day a new revelation from God, one that's capable of renewing our hope and of establishing the destiny that we've been promised from immemorial, times immemorial. In the process of doing this, I find that we as Baha'is have to think about where we are in the whole process. You know, we're all born into a society and a family. We have a certain educational standards around us. They're all different. And we absorb them, and we kind of take the nature of our consciousness derives from that. We have borrowed all these things. And this seems to be part of the nature of life, is that we come into this circumstance and eventually come to a place where we start straightening out or modifying our consciousness, if you will. And in so doing, we have to think about the things that don't correspond to the teachings of the faith that we have accepted as part of the reality of our existence. That would include the attitudes of our parents towards the faith. Even when we're Baha'i Zadehs, even when we've been born in a Baha'i family, there's certain inherited ways of looking at life and what's proper and what isn't and what can be done and what isn't, which don't necessarily correspond to the Baha'i teachings. And we have the challenge then of looking at that in our own lives. We have the challenge of our peers and our surroundings giving little importance to religion in daily life and so on. We have the concept that we've absorbed ourselves that maybe Sunday is an appropriate time for religion and the rest of the time probably not. That we have a concept that some of us have imbibed that the Baha'i standard is so high that I can't get there anyway, and here's the standard of the world and here's Baha'u'llah's standard. So I'll put myself in the middle somewhere. After all, Baha'u'llah does say moderation, doesn't he say moderation? So now we have this moderate position, which, as far as I can figure out, is halfway between hot and cold. In other words, lukewarm. And I think Christ says the Lord will spew the lukewarm from his mouth. Well, it doesn't sound like a very pleasant experience. I think we should rather hold to the standard of Baha'u'llah. Now, the standard of Baha'u'llah, I would say, is moderation. So if you want to exceed that standard, you may be immoderate. And if you want to do more than Baha'u'llah asks you to do, which I can hardly figure out what that could be, then you would have gone out of the limits and you would have been fanatic. But to adhere to Baha'u'llah's standard, which is such a challenge to us anyway, is very, very important to absorb the teachings. Now, it seems to me we have this kind of faith that's, as I say, is based on all kinds of borrowed factors that we have to little by little replace. It's like a murk of sorts, not you, me, murk, that gradually has to put the crystals of revelation, the verses of God into it, until suddenly it transforms itself into a crystal. And then it becomes light absorbing and light refracting, light reflecting. It's a very different state of being. And Abdu'l-Bahá calls it the spirit of faith, attaining the spirit of faith. And sometimes we think that by saying we're Baha'is, that fulfills the requirement. But Abdu'l-Bahá says there's lots of people that carry the name Baha'i that aren't Baha'is, and there's others that haven't formally embraced the cause, but live the Baha'i life. So we have to think a lot about that. How do we replace our former ideas with the ideas of the cause? And it strikes me that in order to do that, we have to study a lot. We have to absorb the teachings. We have to make a deep and, as Shoghi Effendi says, painstaking effort to absorb the literature of the cause. Now, in the present development of this new phase of Baha'i culture that we're in, we do a lot of that through an institute course, through the Ruhi courses. These Ruhi courses are intended to train the Baha'is, to give them confidence and capacity to be able to carry out the core activities and to serve the cause as best they can. But at the same time, the House of Justice has reiterated in the Rizwan 2010 message that the obligation, the standing obligation of all Baha'is to gain a greater understanding and to come to a deeper appreciation of the stupendous revelation of Baha'u'llah is a constant. I would like to propose that we have two different kinds of obligations. We have certain group activities that we have going on now, but that we can't separate those from the individual obligations that we have. For example, we do a lot of deepening, or we do a lot of study, the Ruhi courses and so on, in groups. We also teach in groups. But at the same time, we have Shoghi Effendi talking about this supreme obligation of the individual to study and to teach the faith as an individual. And so much of our time is not spent in the organized activities of the community, but in our workplace or in our studies or with our families, where we have the opportunity to individually teach the faith. And also we have hours of the day where you can't carry on collective activities, where we should be studying the cause and reading the writings. We found an extraordinary letter that the Guardian had written where he was recommending to someone, he urged you to at least find a few hours a day to read the revelation of Baha'u'llah. I'm not quite sure what few hours means. It sounds like more than two even, maybe. And I saw a wonderful letter of Howard Colby Ives written to a new Baha'i where he was recommending to her that she should at start with 2 hours of reading of the writings every day and deepen herself in the writings, and gradually it would become so attractive to her that she would not be able to want to give it up for a moment. And that should be the goal. This is what should happen to us, that in our increased reading, if we can find the time, or somehow we have to find the time, we accelerate this process of changing the consciousness that we have acquired, borrowed, adopted from around us, to that eye that Baha'u'llah wants us to see with, to the ear that he wants us to hear with. in which then, as we survey the revelation, we get all kinds of treasures out of it that we may not have understood previously. If we don't delve deeply into the seas, Baha'u'llah says, Shoghi Effendi says that the writings of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Baha are like vast seas that we should be diving into and exploring and bringing up the treasures from. And he says, if we don't collect these treasures, we will fall short of being able to recount them adequately, if you will, to others. How can the poor give to the poor? And I think that you realize I'm giving you all private opinions here. There's nothing official or institutional about what I'm saying. But I have the feeling that we have to quicken our own spiritual lives to a much greater degree if we want to see the masses of people come towards us. Because those things, as we draw closer to Baha'u'llah, of course, we intimately draw closer to each other. And that attraction in the community and amongst the Baha'is is the iman, the magnet, which will bring people to us. Otherwise, if they see qualities other than the Baha'i qualities that we're talking about in our actions with each other, they drift away, they're repelled. Even though they might like the ideas of the faith at first. So important, Abdu'l-Baha says, to live the life. He talks about two kinds of Baha'is. We have a teacher who's very deepened in the cause, knows all the proofs, able to present the faith adequately, which is a goal that we all have, trying to do that. That's one kind of category. Then he says there's another kind of Baha'i where the proofs are not the oral proofs that he has, but the proof of his own person or her person. That is, the Baha'i themselves is illumined with the revelation. It's settled in them. The spirit of faith has breathed into the human heart, into the human spirit, and created a new kind of being. And we hear about this new race of men, but somehow it seems very far off. As far as I can understand from what Shoghi Effendi said, that new race of men is the one that's wholly dedicated to the will of God. And this is a very difficult transition because it apparently seems like we're giving up our individuality and our own distinct separateness, which we have grown up with and learned to admire and or not. We have to give that up. We have to embrace another, a higher reality. And that reality is the one that illumines those particular names and attributes of God, which are our own inherent signature from God. You know, we're told we're all the cells of one body, but the body cells are all different. We're all the leaves of one tree, but if you examine the leaves, every leaf is distinct. And so we all are the expression, potentially, Baha'u'llah says, of all the names and attributes of God, each one of us. But in order to reflect the name of God, the unique, the one, the single, we also have a singular identity, different from everybody else. So the expression of spirit through your reality can only be expressed through your reality. It's a one-time thing. It's coming into the world of creation, and in the writings of Baha'u'llah, when he talks about the next world, he says one of the things we'll want to do is to witness the reality of every sanctified soul. What does that mean? First he tells us we'll be in the company of the holy ones, and we'll attain to the presence of the prophets and messengers of God. And they will inquire of us that which we have, what has befallen us in the path of God. And so I think it's good to remind ourselves that if we haven't suffered very much, it may be a very short interview. But if we've given our lives and we've suffered the whole way, all the way to the end, well, we'll have much more joy out of it all. Witnessing the reality of every sanctified soul, it seems to me that is the name that Baha'u'llah has given for seeing the light of God shining out of you in a unique way that it doesn't shine out of anybody else. You know, they used to say about the religion, I don't like religion, everybody's like sheep, I have to do the same thing. Actually, it's just the opposite. the great reality of religion. Think of the hands of the cause of God, each one of them so distinct and shining in their very particular way. They had a meeting that tried to figure out, what is a hand of the cause? What caused Shoghi Effendi to make us hands of the cause? Maybe we could find some more hands or something. That was originally, the hands didn't know what they were going to do with their institution. And they couldn't come to any conclusion except submissiveness and obedience to the guardian of the cause. That was the one common element amongst them all. Now we think of them, there's nothing similar between the different hands of the cause. They're all were inspirational to us. I don't know how many of you have seen Hands of the Cause. Maybe we're getting too far beyond that, but I think you can all recall those Baha'is that have been radiant enough to impress you with their presence. And you realize that they have somehow attracted this light of God, the light of this of their inner spirit. They've set the lamp of their own inner being aglow, and that is so attractive. And they have an appeal then immediately to other people. So this is this other kind of Baha'is that have the light of God now established in them. They have acquired the spirit of faith. Abdu'l-Bahá says the spirit of faith is the Holy Spirit, the breath of the Holy Spirit breathed into man. Now, that's something that's active. It isn't something that is acquired and that's the end of it. It has to be renewed all the time. So we're not always steady in our position of faith. It goes up and down. Abdu'l-Bahá talks about interpreting one of the hidden words where he talks about the heights of fidelity. He said that this is a very high station. There is a very high station of faith that one can attain to, but he said it's very difficult to maintain it yourself there. You come into it for moments, perhaps, and then you drop back again. So this whole attitude of becoming what Abdu'l-Bahá calls incarnate light in the divine plan, he calls upon us to become incarnate light. The challenge is terrific. And I think at times we don't, I mean, I know myself, I wonder what exactly that means. I see it sometimes in other people, but. Now, because the unique set of names in you is different from anybody else, your contribution that you can make to the cause can't be made by anyone else. It can only be made by you. And you deprive creation, if you don't develop this level of perfection, you deprive creation of that expression. So in a sense, you bear kind of a weight of guilt about that. Because God has given us the message, He's given us the revelation. What are we doing with it? Are we headed to the goal? Or have we sat down and decided it's too difficult, or made excuses for ourselves, all of which brings then tests and other difficulties to develop our awareness and our wish to improve? What do the prayers say that we say every day? Shoghi Effendi, in the last years of his life, in so many of the letters that he wrote back to the friends, talked about, and in messages in general too, talked about four aspects to Baha'i life. He said they were prayer, meditation, study, and action. And sometimes with the pilgrims, he'd elaborate a bit. He said we should, for prayer as an example of prayer and meditation, we should look to the Persians. And for study, we should look to the Germans, who were nothing superficial. They had learned Arabic and Persian, and I mean, he was, of course, thinking about the hands of the cause that he eventually named. And action at that time, in any case, he said, look to the Americans, because they had so many of them arisen in the beginning of the crusade and gone out to open these very difficult places. I mean, housewives going to strange islands in the Indian Ocean and things like that. It's quite a challenge. So he says these should be in balance, in equilibrium in our life. And the action is the only one really that relates to collective activity. You can have study classes together, and you can have devotionals together, that's true. But these four are something going on at our own inner level, and we have to draw from them the strength and integrity of our service, of our action. And if we get too concentrated on the outside methods and ways of the plans and so on, without this fortification, this inner fortification, this spiritual fortification, we lose our push a little bit. And we find ourselves then saying, well, I'm a little bit tired to go out. I don't know. I can't go to another reflection meeting. I don't see anybody reflecting there. Does it occur to you that maybe you're supposed to bring something to that meeting, you know, if you don't get what you want out of it? The plan of the divine plan, the stages of the divine plan, the five-year plan that we're engaged in, is like a ship on the sea of the cause, the sea of revelation. If the revelation is lost from sight by us not continually renewing and expanding our vision, this boat's going to end up on dry land, you know. The Baha'is have to constantly renew this their vision of the cause and take from it the treasures that it has. And that's what you share then. It doesn't mean necessarily you'll be explaining the questions of the seal of the prophet and the 12th Qayyim or the Qayyim and to anybody. But the breadth of vision that you have about the cause will inform the simplest of explanations that you give about the faith. In other words, it's a presence with us, isn't it? And then from that base, you feel the inspiration. Also, the Baha'u'llah himself says we should teach ourselves before we teach others. We have to enrich ourselves so that we have something to give. And of course, that's a kind of opposite on the globe to the fact that he can inspire anybody that opens their mouth to talk about the faith with whatever he wants. And that happens to us too. But we don't want to just depend on that when we have all these instructions to deepen ourselves and study and acquire the breadth of vision that we need. And that taking those actions then will make teaching a joy to us. And in a recent letter I saw of Shoghi Effendi, he said, if we take these steps, these four steps and so on, he says, then Baha'u'llah will send us souls. He doesn't say he'll send us souls anyway. We have to go look for them most of the time. But he says, if we take the right inner actions, then Baha'u'llah will lead souls to us, and we'll find waiting souls. There are waiting souls all around us. I think he doesn't always connect us because we're a little bit under the mark for awakening them spiritually. You know, it's like the house just said years ago, some of the places we went, we did such fast teaching, he said it was kind of like a vaccination of the population against the faith. They embraced the cause, they loved the cause, and we never went back. Then when you go back the next time after 2 years and say, I have a list of here, some Baha'is and so on, they say, oh, they don't care to know about it. And that was part of the reason why we've gotten into a much more elaborate system for the expansion and consolidation of the faith, because we were losing numbers of those that came in the 80s, the 70s and the 80s, they were going out again. Baha'is who were teaching them were very excited. I was amongst them, excited, but we almost never went back again. The idea was current in the community that Baha'u'llah will take care of his own. And if you got assigned a consolidation task and had to go try to find those old believers, you became disheartened very quickly. Because they can't be left to their own devices, as Shoghi Effendi says. You have to stay with the new believers. Now that happens right now in our study circles and things. The study circle provides an example of Baha'i fellowship. It also provides a certain continuity of interaction with the other Baha'is that helps to consolidate the people, apart from whatever they happen to be studying in the Ruhi Book 1 or 2 or whatever it is. So this has led, particularly in third world countries and places where the friends gather together, has led to a new kind of association that they have. And it's important for us to recognize that's part of the process of being able to attract and hold masses of people, which, given the message that we have, we want to get it out there so that it will provide the basis for this new world order that Baha'u'llah has promised will come into being. There are three ages, as you know, in the Baha'i era: the heroic age of the faith, the first age, which includes the central figures of the faith, Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Baha, and then the formative age, which, as the House has reminded us now, is 10 years, 9 years away now until we come to the centenary of the founding of the formative age in 2021. And that's the end of this whole series of plans, 18 years of plans that we've had related to the preparing us for entry by troops. Then the formative age of the faith closes when we enter the golden age of the faith. We don't know the dates yet, the timing on that. And it seems like it's somewhat dependent on what we do in the meanwhile, how soon that will come. But Shoghi Effendi, in his writings, refers to the forces of light and darkness. And these forces are the creative energies, these dynamic forces released by the manifestation of God with his revelation. Through the verses that he reveals, they stay inherent in the verses, and that's a mysterious process, how something spiritual, an inspiration in the heart and mind of the manifestation, then becomes a sound spoken in the air, a physical sound, and then becomes scratches of ink on a paper that 100 years later you look at that paper or a copy of it, and you're able to go back and commune with the spirit that was released when the verses were first revealed. Think of that. I mean, think of the Bible inspiring people down through the centuries. It's an amazing thing. He says, this is no ordinary word. Don't ever take our word as an ordinary word. There's nothing ordinary about it. Every single word the manifestation reveals is endowed with a terrific power. The Bab starts explaining in his writings about the Surah of Kosar from the Quran, three verses. He writes 750 pages of revelation about the meaning of those three verses. Oceans, he said, surge in every word, in every verse. Not only that, he says, in every letter. He begins to interpret the individual letters of the individual words of those verses from the Quran, unexplained mysteries and beautiful things from them. So we never can take it just as something very limited. These forces are released. They're there, latent in the words. It depends, of course, on the attitude that we approach them with, how we read them, how we perceive them, whether all of their power flows to us or not. We have such things that you're very aware of course, the obligatory prayers and the fast, with the marvelous prayers of the fast. I think the fast is so linked to those prayers that it's one and the same thing, where we constantly are feeding ourselves spiritually. Now, most of us wouldn't, as busy as we are, we wouldn't say, I'm very busy this week, so I haven't eaten lunch and I haven't eaten dinner all week. Because we realize what happens, you know, at the end of the week we're going to get very tired and exhausted, if not sick. But sometimes we might think, well, I just didn't have time for the obligatory prayer and Baha'u'llah will just have to forgive me and so on. Abdu'l-Baha says there's two legitimate excuses for not saying the obligatory prayer. Do you remember those? One is that you're so sick that you can't get up out of bed. And the other one is that you're insane. So that's our choice, really, if we miss the obligatory prayer. Verses morning and evening. Sometimes the Baha'is say, well, the verses morning and evening, that's when I study the cause. I read, you know, a paragraph here and a paragraph there. And Baha'u'llah says in the Aqdas that those verses are to give wings to the spirit. It's a kind of a refreshment that we take. But I think we have to see that as separate from the challenge of painstakingly delving into Baha'i literature. And even further than that, he says, digesting the literature. And then he says, further than that, mastering its contents. Can you imagine the challenge we all have to master the contents of the Kitab-e-Ghan and to master the contents of some answered questions and to master the contents and the narratives and details of Nabil's narrative, because it's so inspirational to move us, to motivate us to a new kind of life. And these are the things Sheikh Effendi stresses over and over. He says, okay, I think he must have thought that older people would get overwhelmed. He said, particularly the youth, he would say. But it's all of us are there, but particularly the youth. But particularly the youth, yes. Particularly you young people have to think about how to do that. It will make all of the rest of the actions of your life different. But it takes an effort. He said he hopes they will take the pains to study the literature. I mean, it is that, you know, at the beginning it's maybe the language is difficult, it seems flowery, or you can't quite comprehend it at first. It takes a steady effort to delve into it and to master it. And finally, in the end, he says, after the process of read and reread and delve and digest and master, he comes to memorize characteristic passages so that you can use them in the teaching work. And when you're teaching people, you can repeat verses from it. Of course, this concept of memorizing passages is incorporated in the Ruhi courses as well. The three ages of the faith with respect to the forces that have been released, Shoghi Effendi connects three terms with them. With regard to the forces in the heroic age, he talks about their being infused or instilled into creation, into the world. And with regard to the forces in the second, in the formative age, he talks about how those forces in this formative period that we're in now, and I think in a sense we are all formative Baha'is, we're forming still, so to speak, and the faith is still in a formative period, and that the name is so characteristic of the time we're in. There is another name for it, but it's a little heavy. It's called the Iron Age, and you may be able to identify with that at times too. So, now, he says during this age, the light is being diffused. Abdu'l-Baha talks about the divine plan, diffusing the light of God all over the planet, all over the surface of the planet, to all the different countries. And the scroll of the Knights of Baha'u'llah was based on the territories mentioned in the divine plan. And when they were had been opened, then we had the ceremony in 1992 of placing this scroll that the Guardian had originally created in the just inside the entrance of the Shrine of Baha'u'llah. And those marvelous souls, the Knights of Baha'u'llah, are preserved there, and of course the copies are available also for us to see. It's quite, I have to stop for a second and tell you a little story. At the dinner table in 1952, As the story goes, Shoghi Effendi was saying that he's going to single out these people that settle in these territories during the holy year. And he's thinking of calling them Knights of Baha'u'llah. And Ruhia Khanum pipes up and she says, "What are you going to call the ladies, Shoghi Effendi? Nighties?" Those present say Shoghi Effendi didn't skip a beat. He didn't look at her. He just went on with his explanation, whatever. Inimitable Ruhia Khanum, yes. Then, in the Guardian's writings, he talks about another stage. We have the infusion in the heroic age. We have the diffusion of the light of God all over the planet in this heroic, in this formative period of the faith. Then we're moving on, and he says, now, as we move towards the golden age of the faith, the light of God has to be suffused. Suffusion, he calls for. He says that this is the penetration of the light of God into the very life of society of the different countries. First, they're informed that it exists and some attraction is created and the first assemblies are formed. But then there's this whole process of what we're beginning to look at, of going back to the neighborhood level and the local level, of diffusing and suffusing the life of people with the spirit of the cause. That eventually leads to the dawn of a world civilization. You know, Shoghi Effendi talked about the process. One organic cohesive process in the development of the cause. The seed of the revelation comes, it's planted in the womb of the world, so to speak, and it's growing there, and in the form of an embryo. It's been nurtured by the blood of 20,000 martyrs. It's developing there. When that allegorical child is born, he says that would be world order. That's why we call the administrative order the embryonic world order of Baha'u'llah. That's the administrative period. Quite different. An embryo behaves differently from a fully born creature. So now we have this young baby that's the world order of Baha'u'llah. He says that then has to grow to adulthood, and that's world civilization. One single process. He took the same example, and he said seeds. He said the seed of the revelation, the Bab and Baha'u'llah's revelation, he said, nurtured by the blood of the martyrs, is growing as a young plant and putting out its branches and its leaves and so on. When the time comes when this tree flowers, that will be the world order of Baha'u'llah. The first period of the growing plant is the administrative order. Then the world order of Baha'u'llah will be the flowering. And he says, when those flowers give their fruit, that'll be divine civilization. It's just to get some feeling for this long view of where we're going. Friends, the ideal goal is unity, the whole purpose of it. And it's not just a materialistic or commercial unity, it's a spiritual unity that Baha'u'llah is calling for. And that's why this coming of age of us as individuals during this period of what we could really call the adolescence of social evolution. Mankind has new acquired capacities and powers, just as the individual does when he passes through puberty, has to adjust to those, has some excesses in the meanwhile, usually, and then attains this level of coming of age of what we usually relate to the age 21, whereas things are supposed to calm down and a kind of adult quality comes into existence there. So we're told by the Bab that he's released the forces that will bring about the coming of age of the human race. The coming of age of the human race is characterized by the unification of mankind, the establishment of global governance of some sort, the political, in other words, the political unification of the human race is the beginning of this coming of age. But that, which we've characterized as the lesser piece, that has to then evolve through the growth and consolidation of the cause until we get to the most great piece, which Shoghi Effendi said was the spiritualization of the lesser piece. Something happens, the human race starts moving in mass towards the will of Baha'u'llah. And then the energies that are latent in the revelation can really then break out into the service of humanity. One last comment, I think in case you may have some questions, we could see if we can consider. One last comment is that the word of God doesn't go out and return back void to God, says in Genesis. The word of God is not like our words, which don't always resonate or have an effect. They will have an effect. And the Bab talks about them being light. They go out as light from the manifestation. If they're accepted, they illumine the one that embraces them. If they're resisted, he says, they change to fire. And this is the source of all these terrific calamities and difficulties we have, is we have a revelation that's been delivered, and mankind, for the most part, lending a deaf ear to it. That doesn't work. So all of these entities or ideas or movements which are in opposition to the will and purpose of God as expressed in the Revelator of this day, they plant the seeds of their own downfall. Everything starts coming apart. You no doubt know about this process of disintegration, integration of the faith on the one hand, and everything that, not just Baha'is, but other movements in the world that are aligned with Baha'u'llah's spirit, they move ahead fine, but the ones that are moving in another direction, moving away from the unification of mankind, they lose power and they finally disintegrate and people are opposed to each other. This is the, if you will, the reason why Baha'is have to be a source of love to each other. We have to strengthen ourselves in the midst of all the dark forces of materialism and other things that are around us, and support each other. And as the House of Justice has been calling, we should accompany each other, so to speak. It's a beautiful word in the service of the cause. Abdu'l-Bahá says, our love for each other and for mankind should be like the light of the sun. He said, the love of God is like that. It doesn't look to see where it's shining. It shines because it's the nature of the love that it has for creation. And so our love for each other and our love for our fellow human beings should be not judgmental in any way. We don't look to see if this person is a good person or a bad person or whatever it is. We show our love to everyone equally, and we forgive the shortcomings of each other because we're all in a process of development. And we follow the words of the Guardian when he says we should be careful. He warns us to not think and feel negatively about others, as that opens us to the influence of these dark negative forces of society. And how many of us spend how much of each day worrying about other people, thinking about them, or being angry at them, or being upset with them? And how much of the energy that we should be devoting to the more positive service of mankind do we lose out in doing that? Is this something that thought for the day, if you like? Okay, friends, then let's see if you have some questions that maybe Nabil can answer or